From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mary Carr, author of the best-selling memoir The Liars Club, about growing up in a small town in East Texas. It's one of the most highly regarded memoirs of the past decade. Now Carr has written a follow-up called Cherry about her early teen years and the confusion and self-consciousness surrounding her early sexuality. Also, TV critic David Bianculli looks ahead to the new fall season, which begins this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As violence rages in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has arranged a meeting with the leaders of the Israelis and Palestinians. The State Department says Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat have agreed to meet with Albright in Paris on Wednesday. President Clinton has been urging both sides to work harder to reach a permanent peace agreement, but so far the violence seems to be spreading. Israel's army has moved battle tanks into several cities as it tries to quell Palestinian rioting. The death toll after 5 days is nearly 50, with hundreds wounded. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
The street clashes that can be routine here increasingly seem to have spiraled into war. More Israeli troops are resorting to combat weaponry. In the Gaza Strip, soldiers fired an anti-tank missile, which injured 35 people in one hit. Armed Palestinians, including security officers, continue to engage in firefights. Some wear flak jackets. The Jordanian army has begun flying in medical supplies. Israeli citizens are banned from entering the Palestinian territories, and even in Israel, a number of highways are closed. The clashes continue in Arab-Israeli cities and villages. There have been riots in Jaffa and a 3-hour pitched battle in the ancient alleys of the coastal city Akko. Israeli media reflects alarm about a war from within. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic blasted the opposition today as tens of thousands of Serbs joined a general strike aimed at driving him from office. Opposition leaders issued a statement saying the Milosevic speech is typical for a dictator on his way out. President Clinton announced today that student loan defaults have dropped to an all-time low. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Defaults on student loans fell to less than 7% in fiscal 1998. That's compared to more than 22% in 1990. President Clinton today called the decline an astonishing achievement.
This is the lowest default rate in the history of the student loan program, and it has been achieved while tripling the number of loans given every year.
The president attributed the decline to an increase in other college aid, to more flexible repayment plans, and to a stronger economy. He said taxpayers have saved about $27 billion, largely because of changes made to the student loan program during his administration. But Republican Congressman Bill Goodling, who heads the House Education Committee, said Congress began to reform the program earlier on. He said the administration taking credit for the decline in defaults was like Al Gore taking credit for the internet. Pam Fessler, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 49 points to close at 10,700 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq lost 103 points. This is NPR News. Microsoft has asked a federal appeals court to allow both sides to file written arguments in its antitrust case. Lawyers for the giant software maker proposed that the court give 60 days for Microsoft to file an argument, 60 for the government to respond, and 30 days for Microsoft to reply. The two sides would then make oral arguments before the court. The Justice Department is proposing that Microsoft be split into two companies after a federal judge ruled that the software company violated antitrust law. New auto fuel mileage figures show a continuing slide in the overall fuel economy, though some small cars are getting well over 40 miles per gallon. NPR's Paul Brown has details.
For the second straight year, a hybrid gas and electric vehicle topped the Environmental Protection Agency's list of fuel misers. The two-seater Honda Insight returned 68 highway miles per gallon in government tests and 61 in the city for an average of 64. Not far behind was the Toyota Prius, another hybrid car. Three diesel-powered Volkswagens got mileage in the mid to upper 40s. The EPA says the continuing popularity of minivans and SUVs has driven down mileage to an average of about 20 miles per gallon since the mid-1980s, when it was around 26. The big Ford Expedition SUV checked in with under 12 miles per gallon in the city and under 17 on the highway. The worst guzzler of all, the two-seater Ferrari Maranello at 8 miles per gallon city, 13 highway. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Union leaders and negotiators for the Los Angeles Transit Authority say they think they're closer to ending the city's bus and rail strike. Nearly 500,000 commuters have been without public transportation. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mary Carr, is the author of one of the most highly regarded memoirs of the past decade, The Liars Club. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani described it as one of her generation's most eloquent, heart-grabbing memoirs, a pitch-perfect account of her childhood in a hardscrabble East Texas town. Dwight Garner described The Liars Club as one of the best books ever written about growing up female or growing up, period, in America. It wasn't just the critics who loved the book. It was on the bestseller list for over a year. Carr is now in her mid-40s and is a professor at Syracuse University. She has a new memoir called Cherry about her early teen years, dealing with sexuality, self-consciousness, conflicts with parents and teachers, and her ongoing effort to figure out who she really is and wants to be. One thing she's certain of, she has to escape her hometown. The book opens with her waiting for her friends who are picking her up and driving to California. Let's start with a reading.
No road offers more mystery than that first one you mount from the town you were born to, the first time you mount it of your own volition, on a trip funded by your own coffee tin of wrinkled-up dollars, bills you've saved and scrounged for, worked the all-night switchboard for, missed the Rolling Stones for, sold fragrant pot with smashed flowers going brown inside twist-tie plastic baggies for. In fact, to disembark from your origins, you've done everything you can think to scrounge money, save selling your spanking young self. It's best if you set out on this quest with friends equally young, because then all of you will be carried through several days' sleepless drive and infrequent pee stops across massive scorched desert by a collective hallucinogenic insomnia that turns the gigantic cacti into, alternately, first a guitar-toting mystic, and then a phantom hitchhiker, and finally into a spangled matador cutting veronicas above the sand floor. You will be carried past these metaphorical monsters by the fire and wonder of your collective yearning towards your chosen spot, the black dot on the map at which your young muscled bodies will be fired. In this case, Los Angeles.
Mary Carr, how would you describe the part of your life covered in this new memoir, Cherry?
It's an age when I started assembling myself, I think. Before that, everything I was, was inherited. That tends to be true, I think, for all of us. You know, you're born and they stamp a name on you, and you're known in your community in some relation to your family, and you're known inside your family in some specific spot. You're the littlest or the loudest or the roughest. And I think we hit age 11 or 12 and we start choosing who we're going to be.
Yeah, and you write very eloquently about that and about how when you start changing yourself, other people think, well, maybe you're being phony. You talk about trying to explain that your old self had been falsified, a mere mask tacked over this real self, which you only now have the guts to reveal.
That's the feeling I had, I think. It's funny. There's a great line from George Orwell. You wear a mask and your face grows to fit it. and I think it's one of those ages when, yeah, you start trying selves on. You know, you're going to be a hippie or you're going to be a radical or you're going to be a rah-rah girl or you're going to be somebody's girlfriend. You're sort of strapping on identities to see who you can sell them to.
You write that in your town, the town was more tolerant of affliction and physical handicap than social wrongness. Were you or was your family considered socially wrong?
I think that's an understatement for what my family was considered. I mean, I've often said a dysfunctional family is a family with more than one person in it. So, you know, my mother was married seven times, and this was, I was born in 1955, so this was the sort of anesthetized 50s. And I grew up in a kind of working class, swampy backwater in East Texas. And my mother, who had been to art school, it also turned out, had married seven times, twice to my father. And she guzzled a lot of vodka, and my father was a pretty hard hitter. So I think my family stood out.
Some of your mother's eccentricities were probably really positive in your life. She was a painter. She liked art. She liked to read.
My mother was one of those women who had a big tower of books by her bed, and this was in a town that didn't have a bookstore. You know, the only bookstore there was in my town sold those little Dayglow icons that you could set on your dashboard. In fact, I don't even remember if they sold books, although it was called a bookstore. and reading saved my life, I think. Poetry saved my life. And my mother was an intellectual. I mean, she believed in the life of the mind. She would drive us to see opera or to see a play. If we could afford it and all get loose from our various obligations. So that was rare. And she was also very tolerant of, she was tolerant of change and of the changes I went through at this age in a way, you know, a lot of moms aren't.
You said poetry was one of the things that you feel saved your life. What, can you recite a few lines from memory of one of the poems that you particularly loved when you were young?
Oh, yeah, E.E. Cummings. In just spring, and the world is muddleluscious, and the little lame balloon man whistles far and wee, and Eddie and Bill came running, and it's spring, and the world is a puddle wonderful. You know, I could do Shakespeare. I mean, you can sort of whap me upside the head. Of comfort, no man speak. Let's talk of graves, of worms, and epitaphs. Make dust our paper, and with rainy eyes write sorrow on the bosom of the earth. For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings, how some have been deposed, some murdered by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered, for within the crown which rounds the hollow temples of the king sleeps death, his court. I mean, doesn't get any better than that.
Mary Carr is my guest. As the title of your new memoir, Cherry, implies, a lot of your new memoir is about teenage sexuality and those early sexual awakenings, and you're very eloquent about that. Your mother, who as a teacher had seen a lot of pregnant teenagers, put you on the pill at about age 15 just in case. Did that encourage you to be sexual earlier
Absolutely,
than you might otherwise have been?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, I think she was trying to be progressive and certainly trying to prevent my getting knocked up, which was a common occurrence in the town I grew up in. I mean, I had friends who were pregnant and married at 14. So, but at the time I wasn't even dating. I was this kind of, you know, skinny, still a kind of borderline tomboy trying to, I was a recovering tomboy, I guess. I mean, the amazing thing about this book, everybody thinks the title Cherry is ironic. And I think even despite that, you know, despite my mother's sexual openness, again, which sort of nudged me in a way to be sexual long before I was prepared to, it's a book about discovering an innocence that I didn't believe I had. It's in no way ironic.
Well, you write that the way people talked about being deflowered, it was as if something you owned was stolen, something of worth ruined. Now, you had been raped at the age of seven. Did you feel like you had already lost that thing anyways, that part of you was already ruined?
Well, exactly. And again, I mean, I think when I first started writing this book, I was thinking of it as a book about the loss of innocence. And again, it became for me a kind of rediscovery of an innocence I didn't know I had, and an innocence, given my reckless behavior, I probably didn't deserve, even aside from what was inflicted on me as a child, what I volunteered for, in my teens. So, Yeah, I mean, I think initially when I started writing the book, I believed I threw away about 500 pages because they were all about this kind of this steamy sexuality, which really I was superimposing the libidinal feelings of a 40-year-old woman and onto myself at 12, and I kept throwing them out because the pages seemed so perverted. And they were perverted. And they also happened not to be true. And at a certain point, I sort of clicked that, oh, I remember, you know, I wanted this guy to skate over to me with a long-stem red rose. All my fantasies and all the imagery that I found so thrilling at that time, had those images were all very courtly. And the scenes I've been told are very racy are entirely chaste.
We talked about all the pages about early sexuality that you took out. Let's hear a passage that you wrote and kept in. And this is about the difference between what you were feeling as someone in your early teens with a boy who's about 4 years older than you are. I think you're around 15, he's around 19 in this.
Yes.
And you know that you're experiencing this little sexual interaction very differently.
It's either spectacularly sad or spectacularly innocent. That while your solar plexus churns and all your body rushes with desire, you don't long to unzip Phil's pants or otherwise dismantle his clothing. Nor do you even get so far in fantasy as to actually envision sex, the brute carnality and mechanics of which would ruin all the verdant, soft, focused power of his kisses. It would slip you both from eternal time into the time of furrow and field, entering and leaving, start and, no please God, finish.
What were some of the other differences in retrospect you feel that you and the boys you were with were experiencing differently about early sexuality?
Well, I think the culture doesn't have a language for girls being sexual at this age. There's not much language for women being sexual, but there's some. But I think it's just part of common parlance. I mean, there's no word like chubby. There's no word comparable to the word chubby for a girl to describe arousal that's so childlike in a way and kind of innocent and silly. You know, I think of my son teasing his friends. Boy, I bet you take really long showers. Or my nephew came to visit me once with a locked briefcase, and I think he was about 14, and we were flying up from Texas, and I said, so what's in there, your Playboys? And he turned to me very sharply and said, you looked. And again, it wasn't, you know, I can't think of anything comparable. And again, I think that's partly because the ways we feel don't ding the cultural bell as erotic. They aren't so carnal. I wasn't hardwired to get the deed done, perhaps in the way a 17-year-old boy might have been.
You write in the book about how after, you know, smooching with a boy, the next morning you'd look in the mirror and you'd think, you know, what was I thinking? You know, looking in the mirror, you think, I'm not that person I thought I was.
Yeah, I think I use the phrase, you know, that there was some schism between the kind of wild luxury of these kisses and this kind of, you know, scabby-looking girl, you know, who still looks partly like a child. Yeah, I went on a date with some guy who was just a guy, who was just a kind of regular fella, you know, nice. I had no particular passion for him and wound up kissing him. And the feelings that prompted at the time were so out of line with my relationship with this guy. I mean, I guess it's a common enough occurrence, isn't it? But yeah, I felt that, you know, I felt sort of lopped off from that person. Like, who was that? What was that? And I avoided this boy like the plague because I was so embarrassed by having, you know, made out with him at the drive-in like this. I found it very embarrassing.
Oh, and I like this, too. Once before being with a boy, you said you wanted to take a shower and brush your teeth, but being concerned with hygiene at such an instant would sound so uncool. And you also are unsure that cleaning up would help. It's the whole blunt corporeal exchange that's eating away at you.
It really is. I mean, you know, it's, again, I felt like, with this particular boy, who was my first lover, who was really a very sweet boy and smart and kind. But as soon as we'd slept together, I had that sense of, oh, my God, everything we'd been doing before was sort of what I liked, was sort of kissing and staring into each other's eyes for hours on end. And I could see for him that had all been this kind of, you know, erotic cheese and crackers, that was sort of beside the point. And once you'd sort of crossed over that line, his experience was just very different than mine was. And yet I had envisioned him as my soulmate, this boy who understood everything about me. And we were so similar, and it was so great that we'd found each other so young, because we were going to have this fabulous life together. I mean, I was 15 years old. And to suddenly see in this guy's face that, in fact, you know, he's hardwired to get the deed done, that our experiences were so different.
My guest is Mary Carr. Her new memoir is called Cherry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mary Carr is my guest, and her new memoir, Cherry, is a follow-up to her first memoir, the best-selling book, The Liars Club. What were some of the books, movies, TV shows, music that formed your romantic fantasies in your early teens?
Oh, it's funny. I mean, I think of that Nick Hornby novel, High Fidelity, mm-hmm. you know, about how you're sort of shaped by pop music in this awful way. Anna Karenina was, I think, my favorite novel, is still one of my favorite novels, which is this romantic tragedy in which a woman betrays her husband, and then because of the nature of the betrayal, she winds up a suicide. I mean, it couldn't be more operatic or unfortunate in terms of where a woman's libido is going to lead her. Songs, pop songs, I'm trying to think. Well, I listen to the Beatles, I listen to Joni Mitchell, I also listen to a lot of blues. I mean, I grew up in a place, I grew up not far from where Janis Joplin was born. And the idea that you were going to suffer at the hands of some man was sort of built into the deal.
You mentioned Anna Karenina and suicide. You tried suicide when you were in your teens. You swallowed a whole bunch of Anisins. What provoked that?
It's funny, I don't think of it as trying suicide so much as it felt to me like a gesture in retrospect. It didn't feel quite as dramatic as I meant it to be. And in fact, I sort of intended the scene in the book to be comical because I sort of put on my black dress and lay down and crossed my hands over my chest, and my neighbors were yelling at each other outside the window, and I thought, you know, Socrates didn't have to deal with this. You know, he had Crito saying, please, master, tell us something else. And my attempt with a handful of Anisin sort of lacked that drama or seriousness. My home was unstable and I was depressed. I was depressed. I mean, whether that was hormonally prompted or endemic to my nature or certainly, you know, it's a result of having a very chaotic household.
When you realized that your suicide wasn't going to have the drama of Socrates and the gravity of Socrates, did that ruin the kind of romance of suicide and make it something not worth messing around with again?
I never, after that, turned a hand to myself. I never... Now when I'm upset, I sometimes consider homicide, but it stopped seeming like a solution, even though the poetry of darkness or dark sensibility or depression, you know, Keats's Ode to Melancholy, I've been half in love with easeful death, and certainly there's a lot of great art that surrounds that kind of despair. I just wrote an introduction to The Wasteland for the Modern Library. I mean, that's a classic example of someone creating a kind of psychic landscape where suicide might indeed biological extension. But yeah, I think it seems to me now really cowardly. And my mother had threatened suicide. She never really did anything about it, but frequently, I think, when she was overwhelmed, that was her solution. So, yeah, I just, it ceased to be an answer to anything and became a kind of cowardly act.
You know, actually, you wrote a poem about suicide that's published in a recent collection of poems, and I'd like you to read that poem for us. And this is in a book called Viper Rum, and the poem is called Incant Against Suicide.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I should mention that I got a letter from a psychiatrist in New York saying that he's given this poem to so many of his patients. I was very moved by that. I mean, it's nice if you can help. Incant Against Suicide. Buy neither gun nor blue-edged blade. Avoid green rope, high windows, rat poison, cobra pits, and the long vanishing point of train tracks that draw you to horizon's razor. Only this way will another day refine you. Natural death's no oxymoron. Your head's a bad neighborhood. Don't go there alone, even if you have to stop strangers to ask the way, and even if spiders fall from your open mouth. This talk's their only exit. How else would their scramble from your skull escape? You must make room first that the Holy Spirits might enter. Empty yourself of self, then kneel down to listen.
I like that poem a lot, especially your head's
Thank
a
you.
Bad neighborhood. Don't go there alone.
Exactly.
It's very funny.
Well, you know, I still have that. I mean, I don't get that kind of black depression I describe in my book. But, you know, my head will talk to me of a given day. It will start prattling at me. But I'm better at turning the volume down on it.
How do you do that?
Physical exercise, which generates endorphins. But sort of the way I say in the poem, I mean, I talk to people. If I'm feeling bad, I have a number of friends. And I'm not above going to see a mental health professional. I'm happy to get professional help if it'll help. If it'll shut my head up. I haven't been in therapy. I haven't been in long-term therapy for more than a decade, but you know, it's the way all of us heal ourselves is you find people to love you, you know, people who will buy your act, and you know, to have someone sitting across from you with a caring expression on your face when you're talking about your pain is comforting. I also go to church. I mean, I converted to Catholicism, so I pray.
Mary Carr's new memoir, Cherry, is a follow-up to her bestseller, The Liars Club. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Pagan Babies, a new novel by Elmore Leonard. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, writing memoirs. We continue our conversation with Mary Carr, author of the best-selling memoir The Liars Club and the new follow-up Cherry. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new fall lineup. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mary Carr. Her new memoir, Cherry, is a follow-up to her best-selling memoir, The Liars Club. Both books are about growing up in a small town in East Texas. The new book, Cherry, covers her early teen years. When we left off, we were talking about dealing with depression, and Carr mentioned that she converted to Catholicism. When did you convert?
97.
How come?
My son came into my room. He was about 5 years old one Sunday morning, and he said, "I want to go to church, and I wanted to read the New York Times." So I said, "Why?" And he said, "I want to see if God's there." And I thought, oh, you know, I didn't like soccer either, but I went and stood out on the frozen field, you know, watched him run up and down. So we did this thing we called God-a-rama, where anybody we knew who had a spiritual practice of any kind, we went with them. So we went to a number of Jewish temples, including conservative temples and small private groups. We went to Baptist churches, Episcopal, Unitarian. We even did a Buddhist Zendo. We never made it to a mosque, but I found myself in a Catholic church that a friend of mine, actually Tobias Wolf, had invited me to. And I was very moved. And if you told me I would join the Catholic Church, I just would have laughed myself sick. And I'm sure I'm not the Pope's favorite Catholic. I mean, let me just put it that way. But I go to church every Sunday, and I pray every day. I think it puts me in perspective, I think. It puts my difficulties in the right size.
Now, your first memoir, The Liars Club, was a bestseller. It was also, you know, important in popularizing the memoir. Why did you first decide to write a memoir?
It's a form that always interested me. I write in this book, the only journal that I have from ever, really. I never really kept a journal, but the only journal I have from childhood, in that I write, when I grow up, I want to write half poetry and half autobiography. So I don't even remember an autobiography I read as a child. This was 1965, I think. I would have been 10, 10 or 11. So the form always interested me. I started teaching classes in it when I was teaching composition and rhetoric in the academic ghetto around Boston. I often taught courses in family memoir. I think I wanted to know how people live their lives. I also was a big fan and still am a big fan of biography, and at that time, literary biography. So I had tried to write this book, I had tried to write Liars Club as a novel, and when I did, the character who was me behaved way better in fiction than I ever had in fact. You know, she was beautiful and noble and wise. She did volunteer work at the nursing home. I mean, for me, fiction would have been an opportunity to correct. And I also, I was endowed with these amazing characters. I don't know. I think it's a psychological tilt. You know, why does Philip Roth write books that, you know, he basically admits are autobiographical and yet they're labeled fiction? You know, I don't know. I think it must be the writer's psychological position.
Now, I know you kept a diary as a girl. Did a lot of your memoir come from memories revived by that diary?
Virtually none of it. Actually, that's not true. I mean, what I discovered from that, it's less than one volume. I mean, it's not very thorough. I was a lazy kid, I think, intellectually. And so I'd keep it for a few days or a week, and then I'd kind of stop and get disinterested. But for instance, you know, I think we remember ourselves in convenient packages, and I like to remember myself as very smart at this age. And I had been a very smart little girl. I think I was precocious. I read very early at age 2.5. And there was some evidence that I was smarter than the average, you know, 7 or 8 year old. But when I read the poems I had written in 1965, it was very clear that even though I occasionally had the sense to read E.E. Cummings or Shakespeare, I in fact wasn't very smart. You know, I was writing love poems to the star of Branded. you know, and drawing pictures of from Song of Bernadette, you know, drawing pictures of Jesus. So I think, again, I had very conveniently remembered myself as being this great intellect. And, in fact, I was just kind of an average kid in terms of intelligence, probably. I mean, I was more interested in reading because I think my family was. But
you know, I once had the nerve to go back to, like, a diary from sixth grade or something, and it was all basically who I sat next to in class that day and what I'd taken for lunch. And I think it wouldn't have occurred to me then to write down things that I was actually feeling that were complicated or what was going on in my personal life or my family life beyond who I had a crush on that day. I think it really wouldn't have occurred to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's too humiliating. Believe me, it doesn't get any easier. It doesn't get any easier when you're a grown-up. It's equally humiliating. I sort of, I think it's inconvenient to write down the ways we suffer. I think that's true.
Do you keep a journal now?
Oh, goodness, no. I don't have time. And I also lead a pretty banal life. I mean, in many ways, I'm a soccer mom, you know. I live in Syracuse. I teach at Syracuse University. And I have a son. I'm a single mom, although my ex-husband is great, and we co-parent really well, and he's very involved in raising our son. I sort of live in this country time lemonade commercial is the way it looks. All the things that everybody in the 50s were trying to escape, I'm trying to recreate, you know, in the year 2000. And, you know, this sort of, I have a picket fence, you know, I mean, the whole shoot and match, you know, and I stand out on the soccer field and watch kids run up and down and shoot hoops in my driveway when my son comes home from school.
What about memory, though? Your two books outside of your poetry books have been memoirs, which requires remembering. And I don't know if you experience this, but sometimes memories really start to disappear and you're able to remember less and less, and you trust less and less the things you are able to remember. So isn't there the temptation to keep a journal just to kind of preserve what it is that you've experienced and know that you experienced it?
Well, I mean, if I were going to do that, I'd strap a video camera to my head, you know. I mean, for me, a memoir is an act of, I mean that seriously in a way. For me, memoir is an act of memory and not an act of history. It's remembered experience. It's not lived experience. There are all kinds of theories about ways we remember, and I have no doubt that my memory is as... I do have a better long-term memory than most people. I basically wrote this book and I gave it to all my friends and no one said that didn't happen or that didn't happen that way. People told me things I didn't remember or they augmented events or they told me how they felt that I didn't in ways that I had no way to know. But, you know, it's a corrupt form. Memory informs imagination and imagination informs memory. So when people ask me how I remember all this stuff, I always say, well, obviously I don't. I just think I do, which I think is true.
You know, one lives through life trying to keep certain unpleasant things kind of secret from other people. It's certainly not the first thing that you tell them. I mean, you don't meet somebody and say, by the way, and I was abused when I was seven, you know. But when you've written a memoir, before people even meet you in person, they may have read your book and found out all these, you know, really private, personal things that you, you know, probably kept secret from most people for most of your life. So I'm wondering if that's changed your interactions with people who you're meeting now, because if they've read your work, they know so many things.
It's funny. I have a great switch that I've thrown. You know, I've never reread The Liars Club, and wouldn't. You know, I managed to not remember or not know that people know those things. I think people are actually kinder to me in some way, or they feel they know me when they meet me. I think, in some ways, people are much more open with me, perhaps, than they would have been. They feel as if I've let them in on something, which I guess I have, even though I managed to deny that. And I also, like most writers, I'm never interested really in talking about something I've already written. Once it's written, I'm kind of done. So if someone comes up to me and says, oh, you know, that part where your mother has a psychotic break in Liar's Club was so important to me, I usually say something like, you know, thank you very much. Why do you think you were so interested in that? Did you have anything like that in your family? And Martin Amis has a great line I think he stole from Ian McEwan, which is, you go on the road or you start talking about a book you've already written and you become an employee of your former self.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that good?
Yeah.
And so my interest in talking about, I would still talk about those events intimately if they came up. If they came up in my psyche with people I'm close to. But otherwise, I mostly just don't talk about it.
My guest is Mary Carr. Her new memoir is called Cherry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Carr. Her new memoir, Cherry, is a follow-up to her bestseller, The Liar's Club. When was it in your life, would you say, that you knew you wanted to write?
When I was five. We had this big edition of Riverside Shakespeare. My sister still has it. You know, I sort of am trying to bully it away from her. But that I actually used as a booster seat when I was a little kid. My mother was always so interested and excited if I recited poetry to her. She would just sit with her chin in her hands and look enthralled, which when you're a kid and you have a mother who's kind of eccentric and whose attention is a little bit hard to get, you know, it causes you to be interested in that stuff. So when I was 5 years old, if you asked me what I wanted to do, I would have said I wanted to be a poet. And that basically never changed. There was a brief time when I used to say I wanted to be a journalist. My mother had written for a newspaper, and I always liked newsrooms to walk in, and at that time, you know, there were the typewriters that clacked and all that. I thought it was really exciting. But basically, I never wrote any journalism, so, you know, it was always poetry. So,
I have a kind of technical question about your memoir. Most of it is written in first-person past tense. You're telling the story about an earlier part of your life. But the first chapter is written in the second person. It's written in the you, as if, you know, you're waiting for the car to come. You're waiting to leave your hometown. Why did you write in the you in that first chapter?
Well, it's funny because I actually do it. I take that up again later. In the last section, I also go to second person present tense, whereas in the prologue, I think it's second person past tense, mm-hmm. which has a more elegiac feeling to it. And I start in first person past, and then I do first person present. I sort of was trying to change the voice slightly because I did have a sense of myself changing. I had a sense of estrangement from myself. In high school, and I don't know if it was drug-induced or if it had to do with my hormonal levels or if I was depressed, but I thought to write in the first person just didn't convey that sense of estrangement from myself that I had, that kind of abstracted way the world was coming at me. Again, I think I didn't much have a self. I was kind of assembling this self, and, you know, when I was a kid, even though it was a kind of a self that had been donated to me in some ways by genetics and my family situation, I at least was responding to things with some natural impetus out of some natural core, I think. And I was much more self-conscious at this age and was always kind of looking at myself, you know. I mean, you know, the hours I spent worrying about my pores it's just astonishing.
You have a teenage son now, yes?
He just turned 14, yeah.
Right, okay, and that's part of the age that's covered in your memoir. Do you want your teenage son to read your memoir and in the hopes perhaps that it would help him understand something about girl sexuality, or do you think if he read the memoir he'd be learning more than he needs to know about his mother?
The latter. I mean, obviously, I have no investment in his reading either of the books. And in fact, and he hasn't read either. And he just turned 14. I don't think he needs to know anything about girl sexuality. I'm his mom. You know, that's my little bitty baby boy. We actually had some interesting conversations about it. He came home a couple of years ago and burst in the door and said, I can read any memoir I want for English. And I thought, this is my big moment. And he said, and I'm going to read This Boy's Life.
Oh, great. That's a good book by Tobias Wolff, who's a friend of yours.
Who's a friend of mine, who's also Deb's godfather. And so I sort of breathed a sigh of relief. But this summer, he said to me, I think it was the New Yorker excerpted Cherry, and I think it was when the excerpt came out, and he looked at the picture, but he didn't read it. And he said, you know, Mom, I don't think I'm ready to read either of these books. And I said, you know, I have no vested interest in your reading either one of them. I mean, if you ever want to talk to me about anything that's in them, I can do that. I'm happy to do that. But, you know, he's a kid. He wants to know me in my pajamas, sort of. I intend this book to be a work of art, and I don't think he wants to know me as an artist. He wants to know something sort of more fundamental, something that's going to actually get him some French toast in the morning. But I remember Toby Wolff's sons didn't read This Boy's Life until I think he made it a contingency of their seeing the movie. So I think that's kind of common for the sons and daughters of writers. Possibly, I don't know. I remember meeting Dmitri Nabokov and hearing him talk about his father's work. And obviously, I should be so lucky as to write so well or to have a son so devoted to my writing.
Well, Mary Carr, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Carr's new memoir, Cherry, is a follow-up to her bestseller, The Liars Club. The lyricist Carl Sigmund died last week at the age of 91. He wrote the lyrics to Ellington's song, All Too Soon, and to Tad Dameron's If You Could See Me Now. He also wrote the lyrics to Ebb Tide, Enjoy Yourself, Pennsylvania 65,000, It's All in the Game, and this song, Crazy He Calls Me. Here's Abby Lincoln's recording.
I say I'll move the mountains, and I'll move the mountains if he wants them out of the way. Crazy he calls me, sure I'm crazy, crazy. As he wants it, so will it be. Crazy he calls me, sure I'm crazy, crazy in love, you see. Like the wind that shakes the bough, he moves me with a smile. The difficult I'll do right now, the impossible will take a little. Say I'll care forever, and I mean forever, if I have to hold up the sky. Crazy he calls me, sure I'm crazy, crazy. Am I?
Coming up, TV critic Deva Bianculli previews the new season, which begins today. This is Fresh Air. The new TV season officially begins today, a few weeks later than usual because of the Olympics. TV critic David Bianculli says the delay wasn't a very good thing. And most of the new shows this season aren't that good either.
There's an annoying media word called buzz, which basically talks about what everybody is talking about. On TV a year ago, ABC's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire had buzz. This summer, the CBS series Survivor definitely had buzz. But the Olympics didn't start or end with buzz. And the new fall TV season, which begins tonight, is almost buzzless. This year, it's for two reasons. One reason is the late start. Just like the Olympics messed things up by starting after Labor Day, when people were preoccupied with school and kids and pro baseball and football, TV isn't doing itself any favors by starting in October. The idea of launching a fall season is to get people thinking about TV again, to welcome back their favorite old shows, to sample a few new ones, and maybe to add some of those to their weekly viewing lists. This works when there's momentum, when the networks roll out their fall schedules at about the same time, and when there's about a month for viewers to check out the new stuff before getting distracted. But this year, WB and UPN dribbled out a few shows early, and some of the new and returning shows this season won't appear until November, or even later. By waiting until October to start, the rest of the networks are launching their new shows at a time when the distractions are already here. We have four political debates in primetime this month, and lots of baseball playoff games in the World Series. Besides, except for Survivor and the horrible Big Brother, the networks basically have been force-feeding viewers repeats for 5 months now. With such a delayed start, the new shows have to be really good to get people back to their TV sets. And guess what? Most of the new shows aren't that good. Most years, there's at least one new show I can point to as an absolute gem. Last year, there were two. Once and Again and The West Wing, and both of those shows are back this fall. But this year, nothing's quite up to that level. There are a few new shows worth sampling because they're different and ambitious, so the best I can do is list them here and have you decide for yourself. One of the best new shows, That's Life, actually was sneak previewed by CBS last night. It stars Heather Page Kent as a 30-something woman who decides to change her life by going back to college. Ed, which starts Sunday on NBC, is a show starring Tom Cavanaugh as a 30-something man who decides to change his life by returning to his hometown. And perhaps the most original show of all arrives tomorrow night on Fox. It comes from James Cameron, the director of Titanic and The Terminator, who is presenting his first series for television. It's a science fiction drama called Dark Angel, and it's visually stunning. Then again, so is its young star, Jessica Alba. The basic plot of Dark Angel is that the world 20 years from now is pretty messed up. Many computerized infrastructures have stopped working, the police and politicians are equally corrupt, and the government has even engaged in genetic engineering, adapting and training kids to be superhuman, superintelligent warriors. In the prologue that opens this $10 million telemovie pilot, dozens of those kids plot an escape, and one of the few who makes it out is Alba's character of Max. She immediately goes underground, but 10 years later, events conspire to get her involved as a sort of secret Avenger. In this scene, she's pretending to be a mercenary and meets in a seedy motel with the hitman thug of a powerful crime boss. And even though he's holding the gun, she's holding all the cards and flashing all the attitude.
Actually, I don't know. I think you're pretty cool.
Yeah?
Yeah. You're smart. You're hot. stand on your own 2 feet. You got a wicked sense of humor. Geez, zinged the boss there a couple of times. That's all I could do.
So what do you think? Maybe after I betray the woman who trusts me and you grease her and her daughter, we could go on a date?
Yeah. You got a bad attitude.
I like to keep it professional is all.
So call her. Get her over here.
Actually, that's not going to be necessary.
What?
That's not why we're here.
What the hell are you talking about? You call her.
Geez, you are so stupid. The word special comes to mind. Did Teresa recruit you off the short bus?
Call the skank now!
You haven't figured this out yet, have you? You walk in here thinking you're going to cap her, then cap me and take the money back to your boss with your tail wagon. But it's really the other way around. You think I'm the whack? The fact is, you're the whack.
Dark Angel has the makings of a hit, especially if teen viewers find the show and like what they see. Most other series this year take very good performers and stick them in shows without very good scripts. Andre Brower from Homicide: Life on the Street fares the best in Gideon's Crossing. But Craig T. Nelson, Bette Midler, and Gina Davis, in their new shows, have to generate laughs or interest purely on the strength of their own personalities. And they don't succeed often. I don't want to start things off with the wrong attitude, but even though the season is starting late, it already looks to be a fairly long year.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Groucho Marx singing the Harold Arlen Yip Harburg song, Lydia the Tattooed Lady. Groucho was born 110 years ago today.
Oh, Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. She has eyes that men adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh, Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh, Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus, too. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia.
La, 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 la.
When a robe is unfurled, she will show you the world. If you'll step up and tell her where. For a dime, you can see Kankakee or Patty or Washington crossing the Delaware.
La, 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 la. La, 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 la.
Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. When her muscles start relaxing.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Listening Hand, Self-Healing Through the Rubenfeld Synergy Method of Talk and Touch by Ilana Rubenfeld. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Armistead Maupin is best known for his Tales of the City books and TV miniseries. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his new semi-autobiographical novel, The Night Listener, about a writer, his mysterious fan, and the writer's lover who has left him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.